Ron Wotus was a very popular member of the 1984 Hawaiian Islanders. You know, I once remember going to Hawaii in the 1980s and asking Mama and Papa if I could see an Islanders game. And they beat me with a rattan cane. It was a terrible moment.
Baseball, old stick. You want some of that American ball, old chap? Boner's the name.
Polo's the game. Old sport.
It's Magnum Podcast. I'm Jason Snell, and I'm joined, as always, by David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels. You turkeys!
Hang on. 10 more seconds. I can do it, Dad.
Turkeys!
Shark has little eyes, like a doll's eyes, black. No, wait, oh, this is the wrong podcast about a guy who's menaced by a shark. Sorry. That was the USS Indianapolis, 1945.
He's not so much menaced by a shark as, you know, love-tapped.
Yeah, well.
This is season 4, episode 1, Home
David,
from the Sea.
I was thinking about Larry Minetti, who was clearly menaced by the shark.
Well, he's menaced by everything.
Mm-hmm. Home from the Sea is an episode that definitely, you know, it was aired as the season premiere, obviously, in 1983. So in the era where there was nothing.
Fact check true.
Nothing scarier than a shark. Mm-hmm. Nothing scarier than a shark. Because of Jaws mania.
But America was crazy after Jaws 3D, mm-hmm. that the shark would attack in three dimensions.
They said, bring it back, bring it back
two.
With a revenge of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they said.
By God, Michael Caine needs a new kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they said.
I was going to say something and totally lost my train of thought. Oh, no. Now I've regained it. Like, Magnum was unable to regain his ski surfboard. David, you're the writer.
Yes.
Is this what they call a bottle episode, or is it not really a bottle episode since it goes a lot of places. It goes a lot of places. Maybe it's a four-bottle episode. Bottler.
Actually, it's a two-bottle episode. There's a bottle of red and a bottle of white, and then you just mix them together.
Very good.
He's sort of floating in stuff that might be in a bottle, mm-hmm. I guess.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, it's a water bottle episode. It's a character episode.
It is.
It is certainly a departure for Magnum PI, I think.
Because it is
safe to say.
Like a bottle episode, what is it? Fly from Breaking Bad, which is literally the two of them in a room for 60 minutes.
Yeah, you're using
it's a bottle episode.
I think the bottle episodes generally have few or no guest stars and no new settings, sets.
No location.
And here we've got a lot of locations and things
money.
Like that.
Whereas here, they're at the polo match, and they're wherever Higgins and Agatha have their chess
game. All those horses.
And they actually go to the stadium, even though they don't go inside, apparently.
So we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
But it's all these locations. So.
This is a very special, you know, season premiere episode written by Donald Belisario, the creator of the show. And in it, Magnum, this is the Magnum is Lost at Sea episode, where Magnum spends the bulk of the episode on the 4th of July treading water in the open ocean, having lost his surf ski. Mm-hmm. And he is briefly menaced by a shark who is passing by and really doesn't menace him too much.
But you know who the real enemy is, Jason? Not sharks, but inconsiderate boaters,
yes.
I think, is the true menace of the sea. Because
I wanted to mention that the Bible of this podcast, the official website of this podcast, magnum-mania.com.
Ironically, not the Bible, which I had argued for, if my mom asks. Jason, have you heard about the real good news? It ain't Magnum.
I believe it's season 4, episode 1. Let's turn there now. Home from the Sea. Yes, yes. It is referred to as one of the few episodes that does not feature any villains or bad guys. I dissent.
I beg to disagree.
There is a true villain here. It is the inconsiderate boaters, or turkeys, as they're referred to by literally everybody in this episode. who menace both. They cause Magnum to flip out of his surf ski and lose it, and then later they menace Rick and his date on the King Kamehameha boat. So
the King Kamehameha two.
Two, yes.
They
two.
Cut their fishing lines by zipping through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those guys, they're the villains. They're the bad guys. So there is a bad guy here. Inconsiderate
and
boaters.
And they have a boat called Hot and Heavy. Mm-hmm. So I mean, right there.
Yeah.
Lately, I've been watching these episodes with my daughter, who is fascinated by Magnum PI and all of its teachings.
And its teachings. Yes. You tell your mom that.
I did not let her watch this episode for reasons that will become apparent when we get to the big reveal by the end. Mm. But had she watched it, I assure you, the entire 50 minutes would have been, do those boaters get punished? Those boaters better get punished. Mm-hmm. Is there a stinger at the end where the boaters are arrested and brought to justice? And No. Sometimes turkeys just get away with it.
I actually lived through just that experience today.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, nope, we never see them again.
Sometimes the turkeys, they just, that's the thing about turkeys, people. Mm-hmm. What you can't, it's hard to fly high with eagles when you're menaced by turkeys in boats.
This is literally a year after Did You See the Sunrise aired, so I was hoping it was going to be the annual Magnum tradition where he kills someone at the end of the season premiere.
Hey, turkeys, did you see the sunrise over the Pali Lookout? Oh, you were in a boat instead?
Because you weren't looking at me on my surf ski!
Bang.
Boom! Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, anyway, Magnum is out on a surf ski on the 4th of July in this episode because he always likes to spend the 4th of July alone. And we don't know why at the beginning. And I think it's interesting because I think it's strongly implied and anybody who's seen the show would say, oh, it's going to be a Vietnam thing. Ah, ha, ha.
Right.
That's not what it is.
Nope.
But he is out there alone. And then all of our other characters are doing other things on the 4th of July, including Higgins doing the most perfect 4th of July thing you possibly could, playing in a polo match against a guy who's American and speaks with a ludicrous, fake, like, mocking English accent, I think just to mock Higgins, but it's hard to tell because we only ever hear him mock Higgins.
He has a terrible, terrible voice and accent, and it's like nails on chalkboard.
How are you doing now, old stick?
I get the impression in the world of Hawaiian polo in the mid-1980s that the Maui Club, which this guy represents, they really had it out for those snooty British people from the Sons of the Sandwich Islands or the Prince of Wales Club. Yeah. I've confused my episodes. Excuse me. Ah. Where this is the Island Championship to be contested.
Yes.
So I think that he is literally the you mentioned the shark mania of the movies in the 1980s. This would be the snooty rich guy gets his comeuppance mania. Again, my daughter would have been saying, does he get his comeuppance at the end? No.
Well, there is a promise of another day and another polo match.
Yes.
But he has to live with the name Joffrey. Boner. That's and even mm-hmm. even in the captions, because they had the captions on and it's spelled with two N's, but they keep pronouncing it Boner the whole time. It's like, really? Okay.
Meanwhile, TC is driving the Island Hoppers van full of kids from the Kona Kapi'olani Tigers. It's those Tigers again, little league team. And they're going to a minor league baseball game at Aloha Stadium, but they first are taught a very important lesson by TC, which is that Take Me Out to the Ball Game is a dumb song that you only truly appreciate if forced to sing it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By your coach.
By your coach. Fun.
I gotta say, as a fan of the original Bad News Bears, I really like Tobias. He's joyful.
Well, he is the Hawaiian Islands Tanner Boyle, quite clearly.
That's right. And he's the one player who gets name.
Yes.
Which, mm-hmm. you know, that's pretty good. He gets to ride shotgun.
Because that's the key, is the one with the dialogue gets a name and gets to sit in the shotgun seat.
And, and to, I, to, to just jump ahead a little, since we're talking about young Tanner Boyle.
Yes.
One of my favorite moments involving that particular subplot. At this point, TC is fretting about Magnum, and he sees a Ferrari going by, and it's a red Ferrari, and he's all, "Oh, it's my friend Magnum. He's okay." And they lean, and it's a beautiful woman driving in the Ferrari. Eyeballed by every member of that baseball team.
Yes.
And young Tanner Boyle says, "I'd like to meet your friend."
Yeah. If that's your friend, you got to introduce us.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a nice touch.
Oh, you know what's not well done, though? I don't know if we want to get into this here.
Before we do that, because this is a nice thing, and then we'll get into that. I appreciated that, again, these are Tigers that have mm-hmm. orange. I just assumed that Arts decided not to sponsor them this year.
Mm-hmm. It could be. So they just got the generic, like the T.
Yeah, yep. but it's the same shade of orange.
Yeah,
so I appreciate
the Kona Kapi'olani Tigers. Yeah.
I can tell you, I didn't play Little League baseball myself, but I had many friends who did, and they would wear their unis to school.
Mm-hmm.
And yep, that's a very 1980s look for Little League baseball.
Oh yeah.
Where you just have, this is the color, and this is the letter on your cap uh-huh. to designate the team.
I was on the Braves, and I definitely had a hat that was like blue with a red B, block letter B on it. The B stood for boring hat, basically.
whereas these days, Little League, my nephews played it, and they had full on White Sox and national yes. regalia.
Yeah.
So they do that now.
Major and minor league teams. Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. But this was the old days where you were lucky if you got a letter on your hat. Now, while we're talking about TC, we might as well just explain to people this portion of the story, because everybody gets their own little story to tell. The story with TC is that he drives the kids to a baseball game. They're at the baseball game, and then they drive back from the baseball game. So if you're expecting more of an adventure, you're not going to get it. And since we are covering this part, because they see the Ferrari, I believe, on the way back from the baseball game.
They do. That is correct. I jumped ahead.
So we should talk about the baseball game. Now, they're driving
the enraging baseball game.
they're driving to Aloha Stadium. There's a lot of baseball talk in this podcast. It's weird. It's the show. It's not us, Phil. It's the show.
Aloha Stadium, these episodes are foisted upon us.
We've seen before. We've seen it in the football episode. It is basically a college football stadium. However, they did play minor league baseball there. I looked it up on the internet. There was the Hawaii Islanders, I believe.
They were there for quite a while because Jim Boughton was sent to Hawaii when he was writing the book Ball 4 about his 1969 season. He gets sent down to the minor leagues. He gets sent to Hawaii. He says, "I'm not sure I want to go back to the majors. I kind of like it here."
Yeah.
But there was a team in Hawaii for at least 25, 30 years.
1961 to 1987.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So again, and they did play in Aloha Stadium. So that part of this
and
is real.
And if, you know, again, blowing apart the myth of this as a bottle show, we don't just see stock footage of the stadium. We see the Island Hoppers van driving around in the parking lot of the stadium.
Yep. It's
very
true. Yep.
Clearly, multiple shots.
And then we go inside the stadium.
And no, we don't.
What's amazing is that they've erected a life-size replica of Tiger Stadium in Detroit inside Aloha Stadium. But nobody will notice because the Magnum PI is not connected to the Detroit Tigers in any way.
No one will notice that old English D on the players' caps playing that. The D stands for the Islanders.
Yes.
Nor will they notice the Hawaiian language.
The low hanging green upper deck that is characteristic of Old Tiger Stadium.
And they will surely not recognize from a few episodes later the fact that Magnum is at that very stadium to see the Tigers.
Yeah.
This would be explicable if Magnum had a week or two to do exterior shots in Hawaii, and then it was back to LA to film the bulk of the show. But they were based in Hawaii.
They were based in Hawaii. Yeah. They're there the whole time. And they literally can't send out the second crew
to grab some B-roll.
I wonder if they paid for footage for the Lou Whitaker, because this is the same season, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same season.
I wonder if they just paid Major League Baseball for some footage and decided they could just use it twice. And use some of it here and then used it in the actual episode where they're actually supposed to be in Detroit.
And my favorite detail, because when you texted the other day and said, you know, that's a Tigers game.
Just a little behind the scenes is that there, yes, texts are sent while we're watching these episodes. It does happen.
And well, the best part was because then I sat there and I'm watching carefully, and it's actually footage from two different games. They're playing two different teams.
Yes.
In each clip.
I believe they're playing the Royals and the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
It's like the King of the Mountain tournament where just one team is defeated and another team runs onto the field.
What's not known is in Hawaii they like to play because it takes so long to get there. They like to play what was called the three-team baseball game, which is very complicated because you'd have to cycle through who was sitting out, who was batting, and who was on defense.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, you know the most how they runs by this? The end. You know how they could do this? Volume.
I just want to say the key phrase in our little chat was Phil saying in all capital letters, "Do they think we're children?"
Yes, let's share that instead of me telling you tales about, oh, here's a guy who used to play for the Hawaiian Islanders.
Oh, I know. Barry Bonds played for the Hawaiian Islanders.
He was very briefly.
I sort of assigned you to tell us the history of minor league baseball in Hawaii, but...
Well, at that point, they were a Pirates affiliate, right. So they would have seen lots of Pirates.
Yes, including Barry Bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So
and Bob Walk.
That's that subplot. Other than to say that I guess that TC on the drive out is worried a little bit about his friend Magnum, and on the drive back also worried a little bit about his friend Magnum. Like there's some kind of Magnum
psychic connection. Yeah,
sense.
Magnum sense is tingling. I kept saying throughout this episode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not the strongest part of this episode. The Magnum sense.
Is that my Magnum sense? No, that's my sucky sense.
Now let's talk about Rick. Rick is on the King Kamehameha 2 yacht on the 4th of July. We begin by seeing Rick explain over the radio to the chef at the Kamehameha Club that it's the 4th of July and you can't make fancy food.
No.
You should just, like, serve those people hot dogs because it's the 4th of July. And I like this. There is a... it happened a lot, especially in this era, but I think it happens in general. There is a TV, maybe movie, but really a TV cliche, which is explaining to someone how uniquely American the 4th of July is, which I think is funny because, you know, it's an American TV show, right? We know. We know how the 4th of July works, but now they have to explain, oh, but on the 4th of July, you just have a beer and a hot dog. And that's the great thing about the 4th of July. But we get to explain that. He's with Sandy, who is a girl who has a bikini and they're drinking beer and they're having a good time. And this is how Rick is going to spend the 4th of July until, oh, the hot and heavy speedboat, you turkeys, you ruined my fishing line. I'm going to look those turkeys up if I get to shore. They never look the turkeys up.
No. Well,
if they do,
well,
it's they after do, the it's episode is over.
The episode.
It's off camera. Yeah.
We assume that later Magnum and Rick compare notes, say that it's the turkeys, and then they bring them in front of the authorities. But so in Rick's portion of the show, we should talk about that. He's putting the moves on Sandy, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. He's got her out there right where he wants her, on a boat, unable to escape.
In a bikini.
In a bikini. And then
there's an Elvis movie that where a girl and a guy are on a boat on the high seas, and it is very uncomfortable because, you know, when the lady protests, it's like, well, oh well, I guess you're swimming back to shore then. And it's just creepy. If you go into this episode thinking Rick's a bit of a sex pest, this is not going to dissuade you from that point of view.
No, he does the engines threw a bearing. We can't go through the reef at night. We're just going to have to drop anchor here and stay a while out here. And she says, oh, I'm on to you. You know, she does one of those things, but it's fine. And unfortunately, Rick, who we learn, I think here, or at least we have confirmed here, he a bit of a snob. He's got his wine that he's picked out. Although he's lecturing the chef about how to cook for the 4th of July, he's chosen a nice wine for his rendezvous on the boat.
A French wine.
With Sandy. It is a French wine. It is a fine wine. And
at this point, I want to say,
okay,
I'm knowledgeable about both minor league baseball in Hawaii and also wines.
I forgot. The wine segment. Here it is.
Yes. Whining about wines. Play the theme song. Hey,
Rick
wants to drink that. We're whining about wines. Oh,
wine
Magnum
about
P.I.
wine.
Yep.
This is vintage stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Literally. At this point, California wines were very well regarded.
Yeah.
And a lot easier to get to Hawaii. Than French wines.
Well, maybe Sandy agrees with you, because it turns out, and this is what I wrote down in my notes at this moment, is,
yes.
Oh no, Sandy has bad taste in wine. Gasp. She doesn't want those wines. And he's like, well, pick something else out, because she wants a rosé. And you're like, oh no, this is the worst it could get. And the answer is,
well,
no, it's not the worst it could get. She makes her own rosé out of white and red wine.
I want to point out, technically, she has made a Meritage. And those can be quite good. If handled by someone who knows what they're doing with blending wines, one assumes that Sandy did
Sandy.
Not. One assumes that she did it in equal measures. And yes, in the 1980s, I do think that rosé was the shorthand for, oh, this person's a dum-dum.
Yes, she's an amateur.
This person don't know wine.
Yeah, she's beautiful and wearing a bikini, mm-hmm. and trapped on a boat. But mm-hmm. on the negative side, doesn't know things about wine. So what's Rick going to do? And the answer is,
we're not eating pasta.
And the answer is that they're down in the next scene. They're down there underneath drinking wine. And she in various stages of undress when Rick finally has the Magnum sense tingling. And he says, I got to go, Sandy. And he starts up both engines because, of course, that broken engine was a fake. And and then he's got to go. Save Magnum. But I've got one more scene, my favorite scene in this whole episode, mm-hmm. which is there's a close call. Rick is motoring along and he goes right by Magnum. And we haven't gotten to Magnum trapped in the water yet. We'll get there. Trust me, there's a lot there. But we're going to knock this stuff off first. And he recognizes Rick's engine. He knows Rick is out there. But Rick, in a series of unfortunate events, is motoring along, but Sandy turns on the radio at the moment that Magnum is crying for help, for dear life, so to drown out Magnum's yells. And then Rick sort of hears him with his Magnum sense, tells her to turn it off, and then they don't hear anything more. But the best moment in the whole episode, if you're looking for a laugh, I had to stop the playback in order to compose myself afterward, is, and I don't know if this music was replaced for the home video or what, you know, because it used to be that you could license like a popular hit and then they replaced them on home video because they didn't have a license. I don't know if this was like this or not. It sounds awfully, an awful lot like Mike Post and Pete Carpenter just did a little instrumental that they had on a tape somewhere and they played it through. And when he turns it off, when Rick turns it off, Sandy says, "Oh, that was my favorite."
Yep.
And I had to stop the friends. I had to stop the show at that moment because it was the most nondescript light rock instrumental. Literally, it's a piece of Magnum PI incidental music playing over the speaker. And she's like, "Yeah, oh man, you're such a drag, Rick. That nondescript instrumental music was my favorite."
Well, no, Jason, I don't know about what you were doing in 1984, but where I lived.
Yeah, go ahead.
A couple of 20, 30 miles away from you, as it turns out. Shutterstock Audio was the most popular dance hit.
Okay, all right.
In 1984.
I must have missed that on the Casey Kasem countdown.
We've got a family here that's suffering a terrible loss, and they would like to hear the audio equivalent of the Shutterstock guy who's looking at the girl while the other girl looks at him angrily.
Wow, that's the America's Top 40 countdown with Vin Scully that you just heard.
Yeah, I was going to say, because...
Vin Scully. It's they're interchangeable.
I mean, I would totally listen to it with Vin Scully.
Oh, it's my
but no,
favorite.
You have to have Casey Kasem for the long-distance dedication.
So not only does she have a bad taste in wine, but she also has a bad taste in music.
I think we're ignoring the shark in the room here when we talk about
that would have been an episode.
The Rick subplot, because at one point, not only do they encounter the same boaters that turkeys.
Call them what they are. They are turkeys.
That have brought Magnum below. They also encounter the shark that will... Don't worry, folks. The shark will be back in a hilarious fashion later. Yeah,
in the least dramatic moment ever, again, playing on Jaws Mania, there is a shark in the ocean. Oh, no. Rick has got a fishing line thing that he's dangling in the ocean
and they've got a chum line, not unlike 1975's Jawas.
Yes. And then and he's just going slowly, and then there's a shark, and he's like, oh no, I must go slightly faster. Oh, the shark is still there. I'll go slightly faster. Oh, the shark seems to have gone. Whew, wow, that was a close one. It really is not dramatic. Yeah, the music tries to make us think that they're somehow in danger. They're never in danger. It's really more will the shark also ruin my fishing like the turkeys did?
I think my theory about the shark is that the mechanical shark that they had gotten for this just didn't work, and they had to come up with some other way of indicating there was a shark.
I think it was a production assistant with a little fin strapped to his head.
It's very clear in the scenes with the shark and Magnum that it is literally a floating shark bit of foam with nothing beneath it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite memories, we were members at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. It's a lovely aquarium if you ever find yourself in the Monterey area. They used to have a thing about sharks. This is back when the aquarium itself used to have a baby great white shark on display. They eventually had to release it because great white sharks get rather large and to get rather aggressive. Anyhow, it was a film, and appearing at the beginning was Peter Benchley. And the preface was, yeah, I wrote Jaws, and boy, I'm really sorry that I made it seem like sharks actually have vendettas and will chase after boats and, like, have scores to settle, because that's not what sharks do at all. Please stop killing sharks because you saw it in Jaws. The sharks will not follow you down to the Caribbean to avenge you killing the other shark.
They're just unappealing animals.
Yeah.
Where I grew up in Florida, I was about 20 minutes away from SeaWorld, Florida, which was featured in Jaws 3D. It is nothing like in Jaws 3D.
First off, it's only in 2D.
It is only in 2D.
Yes.
They could only afford 2D because Disney bought up the rest of the area.
Mm-hmm. And Dennis Quaid is not employed by the park.
No. No, he just hangs out there.
Bess Armstrong, on the other hand, is employed by the park, and God bless her for it.
All right. We should talk about Higgins. So, like I said, Higgins has a polo thing. They lose at polo, by the way. That's the real tragedy here.
Oh, spoiler.
On the 4th of July, they lose at polo. He does mention Magnum and has some sort of a premonition. The Magnum sense is hitting everybody pretty heavy.
Well, he says something derogatory and then just pauses. He's like, I just felt like I spoke ill of the dead. And Agatha says, you've said much worse about him. But
yes!
This one, because it's the spider sense.
It's the Magnum ESP.
We might be giving the impression we don't like this episode, and I love this episode.
We just have to knock off all of the side plots before we get to the big one.
Parts of it are quite crazy, but this is a very well-done hour of TV.
It is.
However, one of my favorite bits in this episode, not related to Magnum nearly dying, is Agatha Chumley. This is the closest she comes to requiting her unrequited love.
Yes.
Of Jonathan Quayle Higgins.
Yes. He doesn't get it. It's sunset. Mm-hmm. She's pretty direct with him.
Yep.
They're playing chess.
He completely doesn't seem to get it. I think I shall never understand women, he says. And the audience goes,
she storms out.
Yep.
Yep. Well, because he says, and he's got this very dreamy look in his eye. He goes, I know exactly what you're doing. And she goes, Jonathan?
Yes.
Goes, you're going to sacrifice your piece for to
yes,
take my
chess,
knight
it's
or
chess
whatever.
Crap we're gonna it's, yeah. You're thinking of you're doing chess crap and she's like no that is not what I'm doing
yes.
And she storms up. It's like sometimes you could be such an insufferable ass or
yep.
Something
yes
like that.
it is so obvious in this that
wow.
if they were going to go in the direction of everyone has their magnum sense, I want the scene where Higgins bolts upright in bed and goes, oh, Magnum's in trouble. And then they pull back and Agatha's in bed next to him going, what are we doing here? That was what I wanted. And I was very disappointed. I did not
or,
get it.
Alternately, if you want to say that these people have a mental bond, mm-hmm. I want to see Magnum floating in the water going, oh, Higgins, what are you doing? But that doesn't go that direction. It's only the one way Magnum sense,
well,
not a Higgins sense.
He's a little distracted.
Yeah,
he has other things to.
It's true.
I mean,
it's
he's
true.
Trying
I'm sure
to
he
focus
got the brain
on
wave
things,
and just yeah.
That's not the one he wants to focus on. Mm-hmm. I will say I love the transitions. I don't always find Don Bellisario to be the most artful writer, but. The transitions in this are delightful
yes.
because they
no,
all
they're
flow
really
from
good.
One to another. And it helps sell that whole Magnum sense thing that, yeah, they are connected because the transitions make sense
yes,
as
everything,
they go from one to the other.
Everything flows together. One more thing I wanted to mention, because as everybody's having the Magnum sense, is that at one point Higgins has a description where he says something about, oh, that reminds me about Teddy Evershaw, who went insane. He had a desire to worship lizards.
Oh,
he
yes.
and he and his girlfriend and a lizard were discovered in an abhorrent act of perversion. And it's just
performing an unspeakable act
with
an iguana.
I feel like they must have just assumed that all of these Higgins rants were just going to pass right by the CBS censors and they were going to let the Higgins rants go because this is pretty wild stuff, but it's in a Higgins rant. So they let it go.
I mean, already just in the ones we've been watching for this, we have the unspeakable act with the iguana. We have Higgins being forced to marry three Bedouin daughters at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to. I know there was another.
Yeah.
No, the Birdman of Budapest. He
right.
talks about some horrible sex act he had
yes.
to perform. That.
Yeah.
Thank God the audio was cut because.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and again. I just feel like somebody at CBS is like, you know, anything Higgins. I think they maybe their eyes even just glaze over in a Higgins rant and they don't even bother. And they put,
right.
you know, and they phrase it. They have Higgins phrase it in ridiculously stilted language and throw in Britishisms. And I think maybe that was part of the game, too. But like the stuff they slid through with the Higgins stuff is it's amazing.
It's kind of genius.
Yeah. So so having covered all of that, the bulk of this episode is Magnum treading water in the ocean, trying not to die.
Yep.
And if that sounds like, okay, that's interesting, I imagine you probably say if you haven't seen this episode, does he go through some sort of like trial, like mental trial? Is he thinking about his life and all that? And the answer is yes. Specifically, he's thinking about his father, who is played by Robert Pine. You may know him as Sergeant Cutrera on Chips, another fine 80s TV show that I loved dearly. You may also know him. He's Chris Pine's dad. He's mm-hmm. Captain Kirk's dad. Okay.
Which means Chris Pine should be Magnum P.I.
Which means Chris Pine and Magnum P.I. are brothers.
Come
yes,
canon.
Exactly.
Right.
And which means that Magnum went to Cal. It all adds up.
Okay. It's all good. So, mm-hmm. So his dad is in the Navy, and we keep flashing back. They're on the beach, which is convenient because they shoot this show in Hawaii, but they're on the beach in San Diego, even though he's from Virginia, because his dad is going to ship out. He's going to ship out to...
I will also point out the beach is quite piney in San Diego in these shots, and
yeah.
San Diego
yeah.
beaches do not have that level of pine tree.
They don't, but, you know...
No, but who cares?
It's fine.
We can forgive that one.
And so
yeah,
this is
yeah,
it. Is,
but it this episode introduces more wrinkles into the Magnum. How old is Magnum?
Oh, I have a whole thing.
Birth years.
Yes.
Let's do it. Let's do it before I get to the serious stuff. Because, again,
yeah.
okay.
this is perhaps the best Magnum PI episode. But before we get there, I have to say, we have pinned, this episode says that Magnum was born in 1945 or 46 because he's the 1950 water treading champion. We meet young Thomas Magnum, who is treading water, you see, in the present day, but he's also treading water in the past with his dad in San Diego at the beach, and his dad is encouraging him to tread water for as long as possible. If you do the math, 1950, and he's five. So it's 45 or 46, which puts him a couple of years behind the episode 40 that we did when he turns 40. So this is Magnum is a little bit older than the impression that we get in another episode.
I want you to imagine David, Jason, and myself, listeners, sitting in the Magnum podcast office. We've got the entire wall with the red yarn that has meticulously put out the Magnum.
Technically, there are two walls. There's the wall with the ages, and there's the wall with the hats.
Yes.
Yep.
So two walls.
And then one wall, it's all about televised sports.
Yes. And then the fourth wall is covered with just Higgins stories.
Well, the fourth wall, we look at
the camera and
we wiggle our eyebrows and go, anyhow, we're there in the office. We're looking at our Magnum timeline wall. Uh-huh. And we say, finally, we've solved it. Donald Belisario bursts in. Clearly he's been drinking.
Yep.
And he just grabs the yarn and rips it off
and kicks the board right off the wall.
Yep. Says, "Good luck, fellas. You almost solved it." And then strides out to drink some more.
Yep.
So,
right, an episode of JAG, baby.
It sounds like David's got some yarn. Go ahead.
I've been making notes because I've been watching more than just our episodes. In Try to Remember, in the second season, when he has amnesia, so okay, we could make the excuse that he's having trouble remembering because he also calls his mother Martha in that episode.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but he's
like Superman and Batman. Then, boy, this everything is connected,
right? So in Try to Remember, he's apparently born in August 1944, but later that year, when we have that really, really not great flashback two-parter with Magnum's wife and everything, his license says he was born January 5th, 1946.
Ah, see, that fits with
that. That was written by Belisario. So you could kind of finesse that for 46 to 50, 51.
Yeah.
But in 40, it's 1987.
Yeah.
So he turns 40 in 1987. And while we talked about maybe they're not in chronological order, but the episodes tell us when they're not going to be in chronological order. When Higgins has a thing where he talks about his friend who thought he was Sherlock Holmes, he goes, "This was before you were here, Magnum," and then tells the story, and we get to watch that story. So I think they are in chronological order.
Wake up, sheeple. That's all I have to say.
I think we're also just going to pass over the fact that Magnum's dad is Thomas Magnum Jr.
Senior. He's senior in this one.
Thomas Magnum Senior.
But in other episodes,
his great grandfather was Thomas Magnum, and his grandfather was Thomas Magnum the second, which means that Magnum is Thomas Magnum the fourth.
Yes, but it's possible that the Navy guy made a mistake, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
We don't know why we know that yet.
So the point is, I'm gonna put the yarn board down for a moment.
Okay.
Magnum
I'm all tangled
is
up.
Swept up in a current. He can't get to shore. He's yelling for boats.
He's in the Molokai Express, which is a real thing.
Yes.
It will basically, if you get stuck in that, you will be taken all the way to Alaska.
Yep.
9,000 miles.
Yes. Yeah. And let me tell you, one time on a trip to Hawaii, it was to Kauai, so not off of Oahu, I got caught in a riptide and was being pulled out to sea because I was out snorkeling and looking around, and I look up, better swim into shore. I'm getting kind of far out. And I swam for about 5 minutes, and I looked up, and I was farther out than before. And boy, you go, oh, crap, I'm going to die. And that's when my wife, my wife, an avenging angel, who is a lifeguard, actually swam in, grabbed me and began swimming us back. I noticed she was not swimming immediately to shore, and my wife, who I love very much, and I tell this story a lot, I looked her straight in the eye and I said, "Swim to shore, you crazy bitch." And she says, "Don't do that in a riptide. You swim out of the riptide and then you go to shore." And I said, Oh, story checks out. Okay. Anyhow, that's my experience, which is not quite as dramatic.
So you didn't have the spirit of your dad who died when you were young haunt you and encourage you to live.
My dad is very much alive and would have said, "What are you doing, idiot? Yeah. Get out of the riptide!"
But at least her Michael's sense was tingling.
No, that's true, because she actually saw me going farther away. So she did not say to her Little League team, oddly, that she's never managed the Little League team. She did not say, "I got this weird sensation. Now let's watch the Detroit Tigers footage that has been spliced into this."
You know, the last time I got caught in a riptide, Perry King and Joe Penny appeared before me and said, "Swim to the right, Jason, swim."
Yes.
And now I have that theme song stuck in my head.
So again,
also a Mike Post theme.
Magnum is for the bulk of this episode helpless, remembering his past as a child. This episode is called Home from the Sea. We learned that his dad is going to be shipped out to Korea. He is nudged in my notes. It's specifically nudged by a shark. That's about as bad as it gets.
Touched by an angel, but it's a little.
Yeah. His dad gave him advice.
Run it down, he plays the shark, obviously.
Which is a very nice moment. His dad says, "Give funny names to the monsters and the things you're scared of. Hey, Herman." And then we cut from that to adult Magnum calling the shark Herman and saying, "Let's play hide and seek. And, how about you hide?" Which is, it's good. Like, he's trying to keep himself sane. He's trying to keep down his fear because this is all narrated by Tom Selleck. We're using the voiceover that is used so much for other things in this show to narrate all of this.
And he says, "I'm scared.
I'm really scared.
Well, that is a great moment.
And Tom Selleck really sells that line. It's just, it's not, for a guy that we really associate with being, it's Tom Selleck and he's just a big goofball in a handsome body. He really, does a good job of capturing the terror of this situation.
Yeah. It's like I said, Bellisario is not always the most artful writer, but when he's good, and he had moments like that in Quantum Leap too, he can really do that. And this is great because it starts off where, Magnum's going out and he's doing his thing and he explains, 4th of July and you should be in a potato sack race or having a barbecue or doing all these things. And it's kind of an odd, very specific list of things.
Right.
But okay. Mm-hmm. And he says, I spend it alone. Everybody knows I spend it alone. That's what I do.
And we get the Vietnam flashback where
we get a flashback.
TC drops him off to surf ski off the shore of Vietnam, which what?
Charlie doesn't come out in the ocean.
Are you okay. Trying to get a Section 8? What are you doing?
Yeah. Too much mash.
But it's this great beginning where he's, he's Magnum, he's on his surf ski, and you're like, yeah, I know what this means. And then he gets knocked in the water, and he's still Magnum, but then as he gets pulled into the riptide, and he, the acting changes, the voice changes, and then there's just that one quiet moment where he goes, "Oh God, I'm scared."
Yeah.
And it's that simple. It's unadorned, it's not flashy, it's just,
That's good.
Not good.
And he's in good shape, and he knows what to do, and he can float, and he can be out there for a while. But he gets that moment where he realizes he can't get back to shore. So unless he's lucky, he's not going to make it because he's just going to hope that somebody finds him.
And he's trying to calculate the odds that a boat will come by. Coast Guard isn't going to come by because no one knows I'm missing.
Maybe TC's out looking for me. He'll see me in the chopper, but then he goes, "Oh, well, wait." And then we get the flashback to Vietnam.
And he starts thinking maybe a plane will see me. No, a plane won't see Butkus from how high they fly.
And the nice thing is, another nice thing that his father did was to say, you know, when you're in trouble like this, focus on one thing, focus on something. Mm-hmm. And that's what he does. He focuses on his dad teaching him how to tread water.
Yeah.
And we have Chekhov's Rolex, where he's like, you know, his father is timing him with this Rolex.
Yep.
And, you know, and he's like, I can't do it. I can't do it. And his dad says, you just did it. You just hit the mark. And again, Robert Pine, oh my God, he's so good in this. He's everything you want from like the best dad ever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he sells all of that. Again, doesn't oversell it. It's just right. And he says, you know, if you break your record, yeah, you can have the watch one of these days. You know.
He is so very good. I actually didn't recognize him from Chips.
Wow.
And it was right. Only when I pulled the episode list up, I said, that was Robert Pine? Holy heck.
Yeah. This is also the thing about it, and this is the way it's constructed, it's so well done, is
yes.
What ties it all together is at the end, and knowing that you replay because what's happening here is we don't know that the reason Magnum goes off on his own on the 4th of July is because that was the day of his dad's funeral after he came back from Korea, because he was killed in Korea right before coming back back home to his family. And he left them a tape, and that's a flashback. His dad did this thing about treading water and teaching him how to tread water, so he's thinking of that. It's the anniversary of his dad's death. He's got this history with his father. And then also, it's literally the specter of an early death that is hovering over Magnum, because his dad
died
young. Well, and
he's actually in the water treading water while his mother is watching him. And in the background, we see a car pull up, and we see a naval officer start to approach her. And we don't know what, I mean,
we know what that
know,
is, but yeah,
we should know what
we
that is.
We figure it out. Yeah.
We should be able to guess, but they don't make that plain. Right. And he doesn't let that go either. And so again, that the treading water is explicitly connected to that.
Yeah.
And part of it is that his father died, his plane went into the sea.
That's right.
So it's even more, you know, it's like all of this stuff building up. And there's that great moment when Magnum is finally saved. And, you know, I'm jumping ahead to that.
Well, but where suffice he says, to say, Magnum doesn't drown and is in fact saved like by multiple actors.
That would have
Magnum
made
sense.
The remaining four seasons of this TV series really awkward.
He's a ghost.
All of the characters talking about Magnum going, I'm here. I don't die until the end of season 7.
But there's that great moment where his narration kicks in and goes, I made it home from the sea, Dad. Why didn't you?
Yep.
And it goes right to the funeral, and he's got the watch when he does the salute, little Thomas. And
right, which is the watch that Magnum is wearing the whole
time. Very well done.
It
gets you in the feels, man.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. No, it's really well done, because it ties it all together, that this is the relationship between the father and the son, and we've heard his voice on the tape.
That specific list of what you do on the 4th of July is in the eulogy, where he says, yes, we're here on the 4th of July when you should be at a barbecue or you should be in a potato sack race, but we're here because we need this family to heal.
Yeah.
And it's just and I want to say, just Susan Blanchard, who plays his mother, they didn't have Gwen Verdon in mind.
Shockingly looks a lot like Gwen Verdon.
Yeah, that was great casting later.
Where they use that crazy Netflix de-aging technology on Gwen Verdon. It's 1984. I'm an idiot.
She's an actress who, the first time I saw her was in 1979 on CBS's Young Maverick, where they tried to regenerate the Maverick show. And she was sort of the sidekick love interest. She was great in that. And she doesn't have a lot to do here except to cry and be stoic. But she's perfect. She's perfect. And you buy their relationships.
My favorite moment out in the ocean is probably when, right after Rick throws the anchor, because he's put the moves on Sandy, Magnum is singing Anchors Away.
Mm-hmm. Ah, that's a good
another transition. And then this is the moment where he loses he loses his faith for a moment. He says, "I can't make it, Dad." And then he gets the sort of ghost pep talk from the memory of his father. And then there's a wedding, Magnum wedding flashback thing, which made me roll my eyes. Is that all from a previous episode that is dropped in there?
Yes, that is totally because
nobody is credited
from the
for that, which means that it's actually something from an episode we have scrupulously avoided.
Yeah. So that Magnum's wife is in an episode. Hard pass.
Yeah. Oh no, I said. But the anchor's a waste of it. That's a really because in the end, this is his relationship with his father, and he's trying to focus on that and keep him alive. But his father didn't make it back. And the watch that he's using is the watch that his dad said that he could get someday and is dangling off of Kid Magnum's wrist at the funeral on the 4th of July. And that's how the episode ends, essentially. Higgins... Jumps into the water and grabs him, and he's like, "No, I gotta keep going for Dad. Oh, I made it, Dad." And that's the end.
Well, because he's waiting for daylight, because Rick decides he's gonna come back, and they're already talking with TC and Higgins, and TC says, "No,
stay where you are because of the Magnum sense."
Yeah, I don't know. Magnum sense. So Magnum he's staying sense. There. And Magnum is like, I need to stay for daylight because he'll see me in daylight. And he's the whole time he's been talking about, what is the record for treading water? How do they know? How do they know how long someone was there? And maybe I can just keep going. Maybe I can do one more hour until daylight, which he figures out from looking at the watch again.
Mm-hmm.
And, he finally gets to daylight. And TC and Higgins are like, yeah, we'll be out there at the break of dawn. Mm-hmm. And they fly out there, and there's a helicopter, and Higgins says, "There he is, and drop me," and he jumps in,
and the stuntman jumps in,
and then Higgins tries to pull him in, and Magnum's like, no, I just need 10 more seconds, and he's looking at the watch, he's like, "I did it, Dad, I broke the record, I did it," and he keeps saying that as Higgins is wrapping him up and pulling him in, and it's just, I love that moment.
Yep.
Because he could still die while he's being rescued. But he's like, no, I'm going to break this record, Dad.
When we talk about it this way, it seems like the stinger where those turkeys from Hot and Heavy are...
Post-credit scene where they're led away by the cops, by 5-0.
By the way, I want to talk about the credits because, again, this is an emotional episode so far as 1984 television shows go. And we watched the one episode where I forget which one it was, where they have the sad credits song.
Yes,
that's the Sinatra episode.
The Sinatra episode. Whereas in this one, they're all, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, Magnum didn't die, so...
He was floating there, then he didn't die.
He's emotionally scarred and physically hurt.
Yep.
It's a cool watch.
So
my wife, the lifeguard, did compliment the makeup job on Tom Selleck that made him look like a man would look like if he had been floating in the sea for a day and a half.
For a day or whatever it is. I think it's just, they haven't seen him in 2 days, but he's actually only out there, I think, the 4th of July and then the morning of the 5th of July is when they get
him. So maybe about
almost 24 hours.
18 hours.
Yeah.
And he's blistered and looking awful.
Yeah. Well,
now, did season 2 of episode 4 address this in any way, or was he just back to being Magnum?
There's no continuity. Course.
No, I assume he was just back to, hey, a wealthy heiress wants to hire me to pretend to be her fiance. So it's, sure.
It's worse, actually. It's, Luther Gillis is back.
I was just going to say.
It's the Luther Gillis episode.
No, it's the first Luther Gillis episode is the next episode.
No. Yep. Oh.
Well, yeah, but I'm sure that took place weeks later after he was able to recuperate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. After his 40th birthday.
Put it up on the yarn board. That's some time that elapsed.
Yeah.
Not in real time. Well, there's a lot here, and there's a lot of funny stuff here, but this is I think this is a legitimately remarkable, special kind of episode. I think really well done.
And if you go to the Emmys Wikipedia, this is the year
Thomas Selleck, Thomas Sullivan Selleck Jr.
Tom Selleck won a won the only Emmy that he won for Magnum PI, and it specifically calls out this episode. So this was his.
This was what he submitted. Yeah,
this was what they submitted, and it's a good choice. Even though a lot of his dialogue was delivered via voiceover, still, you know, very impressive.
Yeah, you're right. He was nominated
a couple of times,
five times as lead actor, but only won the once in 1984.
Mm-hmm. And probably because this one hits you in the solar plexus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good. And even the character details that dovetail, like the fact that at least two of the subplots are talking about teamwork and the importance of the polo team and the baseball team. And so you get that resonance of, oh, well, see, these guys are a team. And yep. Learning that Higgins apparently mostly swam the English Channel at some point, mm-hmm. which that's kind of a bizarre little detail and very unrealistic. But of course, he was rescued by someone in a Higgins boat, which is not related to him. And then he explains what that is. And you know,
this show. Such a strange show.
I want to point out that Jeff Hesse, or Heiss, who plays Joffrey, the sniggering polo player.
It's pronounced Boner.
Yeah.
Jeff Boner.
Has appeared in Lost and Magnum PI and both flavors of Hawaii Five-0 and Into the Blue 2. So I assume he's a Hawaii-based actor who, whenever there's a production, he was actually in three episodes of Magnum. Only once does he play a sniggering polo player. So there is no return of Joffrey Bonner to torment Higgins. In future episodes.
Oh, man. Well, local actor makes good, I guess.
Yeah.
Local island actor. All right. Well, that is Home from the Sea. What an episode. Bumper episode of this show and that show.
And, right up there with Did You See the Sunrise, in my opinion.
I think so.
In the Magnum canon.
I would put it in the top five easily.
Yeah. I think legitimately good episode.
Yep.
Dare I look at the Bible of our show, Magnumania, to see where it is in the top 40? I think I have to now.
I'm looking as well.
Oh, it's number 6. Okay. All right.
No, Apostate. Apostate.
It's like,
I mean,
Laura is
memories
8,
are
right?
Forever
so,
is 4th. Mm. So.
And Laura is terrible. So.
Yeah. Laura is terrible.
Who knows?
Memories Are Forever is terrible. Death and Taxes is terrible.
Anyway, this has been Magnum Podcast, and we'll be back next week with another episode that I'm going to guarantee right now is not going to be as good as Home from the Sea, but the episode of the podcast will be great, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
But just from the musical numbers.
Until then, I'm Jason Snell, and they've been Phil Michaels and David J. Laura. Bye, guys. You turkeys.
I got nothing.
Turkeys!